Today on Against the Grain, we take a look at the U.S. Constitution, an object of great political veneration in this country. Legal scholar Aziz Rana examines the contradictions within it, which have allowed for the authoritarianism of the Trump administration. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The Constitution and its purported checks and balances is celebrated as the embodiment of democracy. As the Trump administration concentrates power, protesters have come out into the streets demanding that the Constitution be upheld. And yet, under its order, candidates who lose the popular vote can become president. Poorly populated rural states have disproportionate representation in the Senate, and the Supreme Court can and does protect the rich and powerful. Aziz Rana explores the history of the Constitution and its anti-democratic nature in his book, The Constitutional Bind: How Americans Came to Idolize a Document That Fails Them. He's professor of law and government at Boston College. I spoke with him several weeks ago and asked him to characterize how most Americans view the Constitution.
I'd say, broadly speaking, the American relationship to the U.S. federal constitution is still quite reverential. I'd say it's different than when I was a kid, you know, the 1980s and the 1990s, and even at the beginning of this century, where there's been a growing conversation about what's sometimes called the hardwired features of the constitutional system, especially the terms of its electoral system, the way in which it sets up the Senate and the Electoral College, and through that, the presidency and the nature of the Supreme Court. There's been a percolating discussion about the extent to which these structural components produce anti-democratic outcomes. But nonetheless, I think the overarching relationship is one in which there's quite extensive respect for the text, and there's also a view that the Constitution is really essential to thinking about American national identity. And in this way, the Constitution in the U.S. is quite different than how a lot of constitutions are around the world, where constitutions don't typically last all that long. The average lifespan is about 20 years. Oftentimes, constitutions are just viewed as governing arrangements that may or may not be serving their society well. And if there are new governments that come into power, they might think about changing those governing arrangements. You can think of a country like France, where national identity is built around a Republican revolutionary heritage, less so about the specific terms of the 1958 Constitution. But in the U.S., support for this text is very closely identified with the basic features of what we can think of as American nationalism.
Well, let's go back in time, because I think there's the assumption that what the Constitution feels like for us now is how it's always felt. Yet you argue that's actually not the case. What do you think that the Constitution means for people now, those people who are saying we must defend it? And how does that contemporary notion differ from how people saw the Constitution, say, in the period before the Civil War?
Americans today, when they talk about the sacredness of the text and when they're invoking the Constitution against, for instance, Trumpist assaults, they're basically thinking of a set of ideological commitments that they connect to the document, none of which necessarily have to go together. So this is the idea that the Constitution, one, fulfills the basic principles of the Declaration of Independence, in particular that it stands for the idea of equal liberty for all, regardless of race or religion or gender, and that this is something that's thought of as a bedrock feature of national life. It's what, in the book, I call the American Creedal Project, after the Swedish sociologist Gunnar Myrdal in his famed book from the 1940s, The American Dilemma, where he says that the main trend of American history is the fulfillment of a creed. So it's this notion of connecting the Constitution to a particular kind of universal creed, and then that's associated with what you can think of as anti-totalitarian civil liberties commitments that are especially connected to the Declaration of Independence. So the idea of free speech, free religious worship, that's independent of any kind of power that the state can impose, and it's anti-totalitarian because it juxtaposes American individual liberty against the forms of collectivism and authoritarianism associated especially with Nazi Germany and then later the Soviet Union. And then all of that is also tied to a defense of market capitalism and property rights, that civil liberties, speech rights are thought of as connected to economic liberties, and property rights is also a purview of the individual independent of government intervention, but nonetheless hedged in by some degree of intervention, and especially the New Deal framework of an administrative state that can regulate the economy so that you have property rights, but the general provision of some baseline of social welfare, so some limited social welfare framework. And all of that connected to an account of checks and balances with a very strong vision of an apex court, the Supreme Court, that's supposed to be insulated from politics and protecting a constitutional system. And each one of these components then a justification, effectively, for why the U.S. is historically exceptional, why the U.S. has a right to assert power on the global stage, to have a kind of hegemonic status because its essence is a constitutional essence, what it projects abroad is constitutionalism, and that here the American president has a particular role to play, so a great deal of authority given to presidential power when national security matters are at stake, but supposedly hemmed in domestically, where if national security is not at stake, there's supposed to be this system of checks and balances. And that's really different than how Americans at the beginning of the 19th century, in the first half of the 19th century, would have thought about what the Constitution consisted in. Perhaps in the North, the most common account of what was worth defending about the Constitution was the idea that the Constitution was a document of compromise between North and South, for instance, over the question of slavery, to ensure that different regions in the country, despite these foundational disagreements, could nonetheless have a national project. And if we just take a moment and take a step back, that idea of what's worth venerating about the Constitution is almost exactly the opposite of the 20th century story, because that's an argument. We like the Constitution because it allows us to avoid addressing the evil of slavery so we can engage in large projects of what amount to the expropriation of Native American land. I mean, that would be viewed as deeply ethically suspect.
How did the sense of the Constitution evolve during the rupture of the Civil War and the social changes that followed it, as well as the period after that, at the turn of the 20th century, which is, you know, a period of class conflict, great immigration to the U.S., and also the closure of the frontier?
So the story of the Constitution is fulfilling a universal creed connected to the Declaration of Independence in a way that would be familiar to us today, has its initial moment in anti-slavery and abolitionist politics before the Civil War, and then especially during the Civil War and Reconstruction. Before the Civil War, it's absolutely an outlier position. It's most associated with Black life and with what amount to radical fringes within white society. But during the Civil War, and especially during Reconstruction, there really is a moment in which, with the establishment of the 13th, the 14th, and the 15th Amendments, the Reconstruction Amendments that include things like the equal, not just the ban on slavery, but the Equal Protection Clause in the 14th Amendment, the right for Black men to vote through the 15th, that there's this emerging sense of national identity that might be associated with something like what the great Black abolitionist and civil rights figure Frederick Douglass called America as a composite nation, as a place that's supposed to be equally open to all. And during this period, it's also the case that you have a growing kind of attachment of this idea of a creedal constitution to broad sort of embrace of American nationalism, so that there's a rallying around the Constitution during the Civil War because of the ways in which the project of secession is an attack on the Union. It's the first period where you start seeing a push by states, for instance, to require the teaching of the Constitution in schools. Like, this is something that's starting to percolate during this era. But especially as Reconstruction is defeated by the persistent forces of white supremacy, and as the frontier closes at the end of the 19th century so that there's less available land for settlement by Anglo-European settlers, that the terms of American life again start to shift away from that Reconstruction high tide, where there's a real question about emerging forms of class conflict, about ethno-racial identity with immigrants coming, especially from Southern and Eastern Europe, with the place of Black Americans in collective life, with the pushback against the project of equality. And if you were telling the story about views of the Constitution and its connection to national identity in the late 19th century, there would have been a broad sense that the Constitution is a symbolic expression of the nation, and so that there's general kind of support or affection. But there's this deep percolating issue about whether or not the existing institutions of American life are really up to the challenges of the time. For that strong connection of the Constitution to the Creed, its primary home is within Black life. And for many Black Americans in the late 19th century, the story is one of a move from bondage to freedom, back again to bondage. And so that there's growing suspicion about whether or not the Constitution as a system of rule is actually effectively embodying principles of the Declaration. And then it's also the case that increasingly the central institution that's associated with the constitutional order is the federal courts. And those courts are largely run by business lawyers who have been appointed by presidents that have strong relationships to industrial capitalism, the railroads. The railroad lawyers end up staffing the federal courts. And there's a real issue about whether or not the federal courts are playing a fair role in labor-business conflicts, where you might have Democratic legislatures that are passing labor protections and social welfare provisions and yet getting overturned in the courts. And all of this is creating a setting where there's growing amounts of uncertainty about whether or not in practice, as a set of institutions, the constitutional framework is actually consistent with the needs of the society writ large. And indeed, one of the ways in which this plays out is the sense that, well, if you just look at the constitutional system, you have reformers, progressives, socialists, even some populists arguing that it's the case that really the courts are not totally out of step with the constitutional order, even if they're out of step with the people, because really only one half of one branch at that time is directly elected, and that's the House of Representatives. The Senate is indirectly elected through state legislatures. The presidency is elected through an electoral college. And then the Supreme Court is insulated and elected through a combination of presidential appointment and Senate confirmation. And so there's this worry that the courts are actually an embodiment of the overall sort of undemocratic features of the constitutional order. And it produces an era that's really marked by intense forms of dispute about whether or not the Constitution needs really fundamental forms of overhaul. And indeed, it also produces its own public writing culture around critique of the Constitution, a kind of left version, so to speak, of originalism, where you have more and more authors that are connected to social movements that are writing books about the framers. So going back to the origins of the federal Constitution and saying the reason why we have this system that's undemocratic, that's not up to the challenges of the times, is because the framers themselves came from socioeconomically elite backgrounds and were primarily worried about the mass power that ordinary citizens that don't have property could bring to bear, and primarily saw property rights. That's the reason why that was, it's really the central kind of right that's protected in the framers' constitution as the primary rights that need to be preserved within this overarching system. And what they ignored were the forms of power that operate through the farm or the factory, so large-scale planter classes or the new industrial classes that can overwhelm any kind of democratic system. And this was the overarching discussion of that era. It produced four constitutional amendments on some of the most significant issues between 1913 and 1920. So not just the right of women to vote, but also around temperance, around the federal income tax, constitutionalizing that, and also making the Senate election something that's now direct. And at the state level, it produced all of this state constitution writing that looked very different than the federal document. It's why even today, the federal constitution is kind of an outlier in its ease, in how difficult it is to amend, in the range of rights, the fact that it primarily has negative rights, and the fact that it doesn't really look like mass democracies either at the state level or internationally.
Aziz Rana is my guest. He's professor of law and government at Boston College. We're discussing his book, The Constitutional Bind, How Americans Came to Idolize a Document That Fails Them. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you were just talking about the period before World War I, where amendments came out of a great deal of ferment around the Constitution. I wonder if you could tell us about the role that the Socialist Party of America played in those debates and what their vision was in terms of a transformation of the Constitution.
So this is an era in which, broadly speaking, there is a reformist climate interested in transforming the constitutional system to make it more consistent with the democratic ends of the 20th century, especially when it comes to issues of labor protections and labor rights. And within this culture, I'd say that the Socialist Party was probably the entity that was most intensely identified with the notion that the country needed to move toward a different constitutional order, one in which constitutional politics essentially collapsed elements of this big gulf between a higher constitutional law that limits popular organizing and action and then ordinary decision making. And as part of this, socialists were really pressing for a very different theory of design. So to get a sense of this, the U.S. federal constitution to this day is organized around a few different kind of key elements. The first is that it has this huge gulf between ordinary and higher lawmaking, where it's incredibly hard to amend the Constitution. The U.S. Constitution is perhaps the hardest in the world to amend, according to social scientists. So it's very, very difficult to amend. At the same time, it has an incredibly powerful federal judiciary in which you have these judges, 9 of them, they serve for life. And because it's so hard to amend, there are very few pathways for ordinary Americans to shift constitutional politics. And the courts essentially have a stranglehold over constitutional reconstruction and creation. At the same time, you have a system, an electoral system, that is notoriously undemocratic because the central unit of decision making is not the principle of one person, one vote, but the geographical unit of the state in the way that it shapes the Senate, the presidency, who serves on the Supreme Court, and even the House of Representatives, with gerrymandering at the state level of the very districts that exist. So you have a constitution that's formally hard to change, a very powerful court, a highly undemocratic electoral system, and then a vision of rights that, again, really emphasizes negative liberties and property rights, but does not have a panoply of rights that today are quite common elsewhere around the world and even at the state level. And these would be women's rights, reproductive rights, environmental protections, socioeconomic protections, various types of universal guarantees to health, housing, education, labor protections like the right to strike, collective bargaining. And what the socialists were arguing was that rather than this system, that it was essential to move toward a constitutional order that was predicated on broad positive and negative liberties, that had a simplified amendment process so publics could negotiate and renegotiate the terms of collective life, that if it allowed for judicial authority had to at the very least be a weak form of judicial review in which you had larger courts, term limits, the capacity of publics through amendment or through legislative veto to constrain court action. And indeed, there's also a critique on presidential power and the worries that presidential power could impose various kinds of extreme forms of national security, discretionary power, especially on distant communities. And so a desire for moving toward the kind of parliamentary democracies that we're seeing elsewhere. All of this was based on a vision of how actually you have meaningful rights protections enforced. Their argument was that the goal was socialism. The goal was not liberal democracy. But for socialism to be something that could be pursued, you needed to have a political order in which the rules of the game facilitated the capacity of unions, parties, intermediate institutions to engage in collective assertions of power, to pursue various kinds of economic and political objectives that steadily transformed the country towards something that looked like a cooperative commonwealth. And so a transformation to the legal political system went hand in hand with transformations to the economic order. And indeed, at certain moments in time, this might even require, for instance, having a constitutional convention or a package of amendments that would formally alter the terms of the constitutional system.
How did the labor movement then relate to that kind of reforming impulse when, during the New Deal, labor had more power than it had previously? Of course, in the period that you're describing earlier, you know, World War I, of course, brought enormous repression down on the left. How did the labor movement then in the 1930s, during a time, of course, of great labor action as well, and some sense that the New Deal might be, for some anyway, embodying some of the ideals of the labor movement, how did they relate to the Constitution?
So I think one of the key things to appreciate is that in the lead up to the New Deal, there's this percolating debate about how do you change a brittle constitutional system that makes it very hard for ordinary people whose only real political lever is the power of the vote to actually have their needs met. And so you have this socialist argument that we can think of as about formal change, that the text itself has to be rewritten or maybe even replaced, and the project has to be about power building to create a condition where you can replace the text. But then there was also this other conversation, which is, you know, people still have these associations with the document because of how it's tied to the project of union, especially in the context of the Civil War, that it might be very difficult to create the conditions for a constitutional convention, even in the terms of the, in the context, excuse me, of the Great Depression. And so maybe rather than formally changing the document, what you need to do is produce informal shifts in constitutional understanding. And the reformers, you saw some of these folks are associated with progressivism, some of these folks become closely tied to FDR, that are making the argument for informal changes, say, well, you know, there's this tool that Americans might have, which is the presidency. So maybe what you can do is informally expand the powers of the presidency. And then, especially if you have a strong connection between the president and the people, get passed through Congress large-scale landmark legislation that establishes a new administrative state. And that in combination with presidential power, you can build up the executive as a site for constitutional overhaul, where you'll have legislative frameworks that, as a matter of law, without changing the text of the document, ensure things like basic social welfare principles or labor protections. And then if you can reconstruct the court by having presidents win election after election, then you can have the court sort of uphold what it is that the statutes have established or that have been passed. And this is a way effectively to shift the constitutional system without formally rewriting it. And I'd say that's really the story of constitutional change in the 20th century. On the one hand, the U.S. has had the same text formally since 1787. But really, the American 20th century Constitution is a fundamentally different one. And it's a product of landmark pieces of legislation that were passed between the 30s and the 60s, from the Social Security Act to the National Labor Relations Act establishing collective bargaining to the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act and the Medicare Act in the 1960s. Courts that have been reshaped through transformative appointments by presidents and then upheld those landmark pieces of legislation to create effectively a different kind of constitutional order. And labor was essentially torn on whether or not to take this path of informal change or the old socialist path of formally rewriting the text. And I think the big sort of deciding issue was that in 1936, labor throws all of their weight behind FDR's re-election campaign. And that re-election campaign was really a re-election campaign on constitutional questions, pushing back against judges that were pro-business, judges arguing perhaps even for things like court packing, and that the power of labor in that moment was really historically unusual. The capacity of labor to bring white working class voters in particular into the New Deal coalition meant that FDR wins in a landslide election. He wins by a larger percentage than any U.S. president since Monroe essentially had run unopposed in 1820. Democrats and New Dealers have effectively a majority that's 75% to even 80% in the House and the Senate. And they're able, because of just the sheer power that labor can provide the New Deal coalition, to shift the constitutional system informally through legislation and then transformative changes to who's on the court to establish this new administrative framework without formally having to rewrite the text. And that moment where conceivably you could have had a formal change to the document, that moment ends up being really decisive because it sets the terms for the 20th century compact that we started our conversation with. And at the same time, it's perhaps the last moment where it would have been viable to just change the actual hardwired features of the constitutional system in ways that resolved or responded more systematically to the kinds of anti-democratic weaknesses that socialists and others had been articulating.
Aziz Rana is my guest. We're talking about the constitutional bind, how Americans came to idolize a document that fails them. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain. So, following the New Deal, of course, was the tumult of World War II and the subsequent Cold War, which played a key role, as you argue, in reworking how the Constitution was to be regarded by the public, you know, through to our time. At the beginning of the program, you mentioned centering civil liberties, a notion of economic liberty, checks and balances. Tell us about the crucial role that the Cold War played in shaping our now contemporary view of the Constitution.
So this era, the 30s to the 60s, was really historically exceptional in American life, both by comparison with what came before it, what comes after it. And we've already seen one element of that exceptionalism, which is this is a period, especially the 1930s, where a constitutional system that has electoral arrangements where it's very, very difficult to build majorities, that those kinds of extreme veto points are overcome just by the huge supermajorities that working class voters are able to give to the New Deal and the power of labor. So that's one thing that ends up entrenching this kind of partial social welfare framework and the new modern administrative state. But then the other key element of it is World War II, the confrontation with Nazi Germany, and then the Cold War with the Soviet Union. And that these developments really are key to the story of domestic constitutional change. And it's because the U.S. emerges and then claims global authority at a very decisive moment in world history. It's a time in which, because of these two world wars, the European imperial system has collapsed. And that means, against the backdrop of non-white political assertiveness, that you have an era of decolonization with all of these new independence movements that are percolating across what today we'd call the global South, so Asia, Africa, Latin America, and then the U.S. is fighting to win hearts and minds against the Soviet Union during the Cold War in a world in which it's trying to win hearts and minds over folks that are overwhelmingly non-European. And what that does, so the politics of World War II, the Cold War, and decolonization together, is it creates a condition in which essentially American national elites reclaim the anti-slavery story the story about the U.S. fulfilling a creedal universal promise as central to what's distinctive about the U.S. by comparison with its European opponents, and what the U.S. can offer a non-white world as a juxtaposition with the Soviet Union. And so all of this really ends up emphasizing a focus on racial liberalism. So this is even Brown versus Board of Education striking down separate but equal is notable because the Justice Department issues an amicus brief in that case. This is the work of a wonderful scholar, Mary Dudziak, issues an amicus brief saying that it's important in the Cold War for Jim Crow to be overturned because Jim Crow is an asset to the Soviet Union. And so that racial liberalism becomes really central to the project of American power overseas, especially in the context of McCarthyism and after McCarthyism. Civil liberties are another kind of juxtaposition with the sort of totalitarian politics, the perceived totalitarian politics of places like the Soviet Union or other kinds of socialist experiments. And that in a way, what happens during the Cold War is that all of the other components kind of lock together to create this official story of racial liberalism, civil libertarianism, market capitalism, but hedged in by a New Deal state, a strong account of checks and balances with this powerful court, and then a vision of the U.S. as standing abroad for what today folks call that international rules-based order. And what's critical about that 50s-60s moment is that if the New Deal elements of it locked into place through supermajorities of working class voters, the racial liberal and civil libertarian elements locked into place because of depolarization, an era in which the center left and the center right kind of came to an agreement about the importance of various kinds of racial and economic transformations, or at the very least ameliorations, in order to be able to ensure that you had domestic credibility for global authority and you had international credibility as well. And this, on the one hand, absolutely produced a repression of left forces that were opposed to the Cold War, so the remaining socialist elements within collective life, but less emphasized, I think, is it also produced a very interesting containment on the right of its own, what today we would view as far right, its own versions of kind of extreme ethno-nationalism, segregationist politics, where groups like the Klan are increasingly viewed as un-American. And so that there's an effort essentially from both right and left to produce a kind of socially cohesive compact that becomes the terms of what American constitutional life ends up persisting in from basically the 70s to the present.
And so this notion of the kind of promise of the American way that you've just described that came together in the mid-20th century and seems deeply tied to a notion of American exceptionalism. Can you talk about the dimension, which although this process may have started with the New Deal, obviously this sense outlasted the New Deal reforms and structures, this idea that civil liberties were deeply bound up with economic liberty, and what did that mean here?
So this framework had many internal instabilities that in a sense have caught up with Americans today. So one internal instability was the fact that you still had a constitutional system, a structure that was deeply undemocratic when it comes to just its electoral system. And the consequences of that, the fact that the electoral system is organized around the states as sort of the central unit of representation, you know, the consequences were relatively less severe at a time of depolarization and in a context in which you didn't have these huge population gulfs between rural and city contexts. So that's one kind of instability that's percolating. Another instability is that the president is asserting extreme forms of national security violence overseas. You have the rise of this imperial president and the courts basically deferring to presidential action overseas as long as you don't have that kind of behavior domestically. And then a third instability is the one that you just articulated, which is the relationship between civil and economic liberty. There's a presumption that free speech and strong commitments to property rights, to business rights in various ways, go together. And so that you want a system that, yes, has some degree of economic regulation, but that understands the protection of property as in its own way, a kind of anti-totalitarian protection, not unlike the protection of speech or religious worship in the context of various types of collectivist projects. That last component really starts to kind of be, the implications really starts to sort of emerge in the 1970s, where in the 1970s, you have a steady pushback against labor that goes all the way to the present. It's the rise of what sometimes folks call the era of neoliberalism. And so it's a dismantling of labor unions. Labor power is dramatically shrunk. You have an era of deregulation. And then you also have this growing set of arguments that, well, shouldn't companies also enjoy various kinds of speech protections when a company decides to donate money to various types of political efforts? That money, perhaps that should be treated as a form of speech, or maybe companies should be able to enjoy the ability to create their own exceptions from various types of anti-discrimination or broadly speaking, like regulatory frameworks, or maybe things that were part of the New Deal compact, like unions having various types of like union security agreements in which even non-members of the union might have to pay in to the union to be able to support various union efforts. Is that a kind of compelled speech of non-union workers? And as the right essentially becomes stronger and stronger in the courts, effectively what emerges is a broadening account of the capacity of business to use arguments that are really civil liberties arguments and what amount to free speech or First Amendment arguments as a way of limiting the regulatory scope. And all of that kind of is part of what sets the stage for these last 10 years, and perhaps sort of most notoriously a decision like Citizens United, where the courts basically say, especially as the courts become increasingly more conservative over time, that the courts say that, well, you know, corporations too should have the ability to spend large sums of money on various kinds of political positions, and that that's a constraint on associations of citizens. And what that does is it floods American elections with cash that allow especially this new emergent billionaire class to assert power, particularly at the primary stage, to be able to have very strong kind of selection authority over which candidates end up being within the range of acceptable public opinion. And it's just a piece of a broader instability in the constitutional order that Trump and those around Trump have really put their finger on as an effort to basically collapse all of the different elements of the 20th century compact.
Well, let's turn to that. So although, you know, you've just described the ways that this sort of fusion of civil liberties, economic liberties, checks and balances have frayed in various ways leading up to the present, but do you see what's happening with Trump as really a break from even those morphed forms? And would you say that the fact that the notion of the Constitution now as embodying an essence of civil liberties and checks and balances, that you're arguing that that was really the product of a specific moment in U.S. history in the mid-20th century in the context of geopolitical, you know, conflict and anti-Soviet orientation of the Cold War, and in the midst of decolonization and so on, that that makes that notion of the Constitution of racial liberalism and civil liberties and so on particularly vulnerable to what Trump is doing now?
Yeah, so I think Trump is a product of persistent weaknesses in the constitutional order that were never addressed, and that he's taking advantage also of the underlying limitations of that order to then engage in a broader assault, not just on the constitutional compact, But really, and this is the kind of the loyalist group around him, really an assault on what the country had become over the course of the 20th century, which is a multiracial and highly kind of plural society that's not the ethno-nationalist project of the late 19th, early 20th century. And we can get a sense of this, how he's both a product of that order and speaks to certain limitations while instituting a break, through like three different things. So the first is to say, Trump would not be in this position if not for flaws in the constitutional system that were never addressed. He's only president in 2016 because of the Electoral College. So he loses the popular vote, but comes into office because of the Electoral College that was never reformed in the way that that reformers had hoped earlier on. He then engages in an effort to essentially overthrow a government when he loses the election in 2020. And yet the constitutional system has very few mechanisms to address an effort to overthrow democratic structures. It's incredibly hard to impeach him. It's very difficult to criminally prosecute him because of the court. And the court is basically a product of that constitutional system, even though Republicans had lost all of the popular votes in the presidency, except for two since 1988, which is, so they won in 2004 and then in 2024, that Trump, despite losing the popular vote, was able to nominate a third of the court, three justices, when Democrats had only been able to nominate and get confirmed five since 1968. So he has this court that then provides him a great deal of immunity from criminal prosecution. And then on top of all of that, that it's very hard to remove him from running again. So typically one of the ways in which states deal with efforts by past politicians to overthrow the government is by making it hard for them or saying that they can't run for future elections. We're seeing this in places like Brazil. And yet that those are not tools that are effective within the American constitutional system. And then the constitutional system, because of how undemocratic it is, it makes it very difficult for the Democratic Party's electoral coalition to be able to claim the House and the Senate and then to govern effectively. That even when Democrats have the Senate, that's already basically a supermajority because the population base for the Democrats is a city base. And so what that means is that to be able to overcome subconstitutional principles like the filibuster, you need a supermajority on top of a supermajority. It means that when Biden is in power, there's a sense of like fecklessness around the policies, even beyond the limitations of the Democratic Party's political class. All of that then generates a condition where somebody like Trump can even win, a plurality of votes that's marginally larger than the Democratic Party's plurality. And so you have Trump back in power unconstrained, and then back in power really with a desire basically to enrich his allies and engage in retribution against those that are perceived as his enemies because of this system. Then, at the same time as you have that very specific problem, you have the reality that over the course of the last half century, that the constitutional order, all of those different elements, hadn't really addressed the underlying issues. So yes, you have an official story of racial liberalism, but you have a very constrained account of racial justice. And so the persistence of various kinds of race-based power and racial subordination. You have a civil libertarian story, but a civil libertarian story that goes hand in hand with extreme forms of coercion, not just overseas, but against non-citizens, against those that are imprisoned through the carceral state. You have an account of a regulatory apparatus, but with the conservative takeover of the court, the percolating set of arguments about how that regulatory apparatus has to be constrained by court's sort of procedural arrangements that limit what independent agencies can do, or by presidential power through a theory of a unitary executive in which independent agencies that, you know, are supposed to limit are intruding unconstitutionally. This would be the conservative argument on the president's capacity to hire and fire. And then you have essentially this very powerful court, but the court that has largely been operating to shield conservative and right-wing presidents. And so Trump comes back into power, and he has all of these kinds of tools at his sort of disposal. And what he's doing is he's imposing an extreme version of those tools to essentially bring down all of the key components, to just reject racial liberalism, to engage in broad assaults on civil liberties, to attempt to fundamentally break the kind of New Deal state apparatus, and to use presidential power in ways that even limit the court's authority within the relatively constrained terms of court power vis-a-vis presidential power. And so if those two stories are a story of how the constitutional set the stage for this moment, then there's a third story, which is really the story of break and rupture, namely the fact that Trump has now come back into power with a desire to enrich allies and attack perceived enemies. And he surrounded himself with the folks that have been the most loyal. And the people around him that are the most loyal have truly an extreme view, which is there are folks that, broadly speaking, are opposed to the 20th century American project and are seeking effectively to produce an extreme rupture from that project and to return the country to a vision, really not even from the 50s, but from the late 19th, early 20th century, of an ethno-nationalist, Christian nationalist project tied very closely to extreme powers in business, in which the only kind of governmental constraints on private economic power should be constraints that those business actors impose on each other, and that the function of the state is really to produce culturally this ethno-nationalist and Christian nationalist worldview, while at the same time enriching a range of kleptocrats. And that's a project, really, that if I'd say it sounds grim and can produce despair, the thing that should be noted is it's a project that does not have anything approaching majority support, let alone the supermajority support that generated the constitutional compact starting in the 1930s, the New Deal arrangements. And it means that to the extent that this country has competitive elections going forward, something that we can't take for granted, what the right can do right now is impose a great deal of destruction, but it cannot reconstruct the society on the terms that it seeks, because there's not the type of base that could authorize that democratically.
Well, Aziz Rana, I'd like to ask you where you think that leaves the left. You mentioned, of course, the earlier opposition to the elite nature of the Constitution from the Socialist Party in the early 20th century, but then Labour and the left in many ways accommodated themselves to this mid-20th century Cold War notion of the Constitution as meaning racial liberalism and civil liberties. Where do you think Trump's attack on that order and his far-right supporters who you've just described, where do you think that leaves the left, or should leave the left, beyond reflexively defending the Constitution?
Yeah, so I think for as difficult as these times are, this is also still a really important moment for left politics, broadly speaking, in the country. And it's because if the right can destroy, but it does not have the support to effectively reverse the 20th century, so it cannot reconstruct. And if the center is really just reasserting constitutional veneration, saying, well, okay, maybe the courts will now somehow save us, or that if we can somehow magically go back to the period that sort of established that compact, that also isn't a meaningful solution, because in truth, the present is a product of the limitations within that compact and within the hardwired features of the constitutional system. And so that the only pathway out of our own moment is a pathway that requires a high degree of constitutional renewal and overhaul. And it's really the left that is the repository of that project. And it means this is a moment, I think, for a few different projects. First, I do support a strong kind of litigation effort. you can pursue litigation to constrain Trump without necessarily saying that the courts are going to save us, but while still having an open-eyed account of the limitations of the court system as well as the constitutional order. But just like socialists or radical reformers in the past, you can see this as symbolic efforts to dramatize the lawlessness and violence of the existing, you know, the existing governing class and the Trump and those around Trump, as well as provide some degree of relief for people that are most marginalized. And so I see a strong litigation focus in this moment tactically is also tied to something that the left can do that the center is largely abandoned, which is to protect the people that are most marginalized and victimized at this moment in time. And so that means non-citizens, immigrants, trans persons, activists, including activists in the context of Palestine. And then alongside that, to pursue longer term projects of cultural renewal around building all of the intermediate sites of political organizing and meaning making in schools, in neighborhoods, in workplaces that were the foundation of left power from the late 19th century all the way leading up to the New Deal, so that we live in a moment in which left ideas have more purchase in some ways than they've had in decades. But because of the dismantling of labor, left institutions are weaker. And so this is a time to attempt to essentially reconstruct all of those left institutions, and especially to think about forms of solidarity that can be developed in the everyday interactions that people have. And so if you're a lawyer like I am, through professional associations, through unions, through medical associations, bar, or various other kinds of medical associations, through churches in the context of refugee and immigrant rights, through an account of a relationship to the Democratic Party that doesn't expect, let's say, the mainstream of the party to provide a solution, but attempts to build out an infrastructure in which, at least in linking elected left representatives at the state and local level with national politicians, that you can imagine something that looks more like a membership framework that's both inside and outside of the Democratic Party. So all of these are tools that can be brought to bear to offer a different kind of cultural framework within left politics operates, and then to take advantage of clear kind of political struggles, whether or not it's in the university context, whether or not it's electorally, whether or not it's in the context of issues around immigration or foreign policy around Gaza or the issue of trans rights, to push forward a very different kind of agenda. And once you have that framework, then you can start having conversations really in a much more serious way about the need both for little c constitutionalism, that no political actor should be able to just impose fear and intimidation on others, while at the same time a need to transform the terms of the big C constitution to make it more truly an embodiment of the democratic aspirations of the country.
Aziz Rana, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Aziz Rana is professor of law and government at Boston College. He's the author of The Constitutional Bind, How Americans Came to Idolize a Document That Fails Them. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time.